NATO has warned Russia that further intervention in Ukraine would be a historic mistake with grave consequences. NATO's Secretary General says Moscow must pull back troops it's massed on the Ukrainian border. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we'll talk about the continuing crisis in Ukraine with our political analysts, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University and Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. We'll also ask them about President Obama signing two executive orders this week designed to encourage federal contractors to pay women and men equally. And yesterday, Governor Branstad fired the head of Iowa's administrative department. We'll get analysis on that. Join our discussion for this Politics Day. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday has arrived, and our guests this week, Jim McCormick, professor and chair of political science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Jim, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
And Wayne Moyer with us, joining us by phone, Rosenfield professor of political science at Grinnell College. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Ben. It's good to be here.
We have our international politics heavyweights on board this week. We want to tackle Ukraine, first of all. After that, we'll talk about President Obama signing these two executive orders designed to encourage federal contractors to pay men and women equally, asking whether that's a policy, more policy move, or a more political move. Also, yesterday, we heard the news that Governor Branstad fired the head of Iowa's administrative department. We'll have Wayne and Jim's thoughts on that as well. But let's start off with Ukraine. If you'd like to join our conversation, as always during Politics Day, 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org, or email. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or leave a message or a question on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Escalation of the crisis, gentlemen, in Ukraine since last we talked, since the weekend. Tensions high since government buildings in three eastern cities in Ukraine taken over by pro-Russian activists on Sunday. Ukraine's interior minister has warned that pro-Russian activists who have taken over state buildings in eastern cities, he has warned them to enter talks to find a political solution or face force. He said it would be resolved in 48 hours either way. Yesterday, Secretary of State John Kerry testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he laid the blame for the unrest in eastern Ukraine squarely at the feet of Russian leaders.
And everything that we've seen in the last 48 hours from Russian provocateurs and agents operating in eastern Ukraine tells us that they've been sent there determined to create chaos. And that is absolutely unacceptable. These efforts are as ham-handed as they are transparent, frankly. And quite simply, what we see from Russia is an illegal and illegitimate effort to destabilize a sovereign state and create a contrived crisis with paid operatives across an international boundary engaged in this initiative.
Jim McCormick, give us a better idea on the heels of those words from the Secretary of State of who these Russian activists are. What is he saying they are?
Well, I mean, the claim is, of course, that they're Russian-speaking Ukrainians in these cities who have allegiance to Russia itself, and that they're concerned about how they're being would be treated or have been treated by the Kiev government. So there is a call, as I followed some of these events, for even holding a referendum in some of these cities or some of these regions as an opportunity to join Russia, much like we saw with regard to the Crimea. So there's a little bit of an imitation effect here.
Mm-hmm. Wayne Moyer, do you have any doubt that these pro-Russian activists are being orchestrated by Moscow?
Well, I think there's no doubt that Moscow's involved, but there are clearly a lot of people in eastern Ukraine who speak Russian, who are sympathetic to the to Russia, and at least want more autonomy for eastern Ukraine. So it's very hard for me to know how much of this is is been directed from the outside and how much of it is it coming from the inside.
Mm-hmm. If Moscow is behind this, at least in part, and it's a pretense to send in force to, quote, protect ethnic Russians, what is the fine line, the reaction that Ukraine must achieve here, Jim McCormick, here, so that that doesn't happen?
Well, I think the Ukrainian government in Kiev obviously must demonstrate that it really can control these particular cities. I mean, it's a little bit troubling when the government buildings are taken over by these demonstrators and actually held. I guess some of them have been cleared by now. But it seems to me that is what the Ukrainian government must demonstrate, that it really is in control of its own country here. I think the second element, of course, is to provide some reassurance to these Russian speakers that they will be treated fairly. One of the elements that we might add, of course, is these demonstrators really believe the government in Kiev is illegitimate, with Yanukovych's ouster, if you will, at the behest of these demonstrators in Kiev. I think that is what has raised the temperature here as well.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, what do you see as other factors?
Well, I think the critical thing here is for the Ukrainian government not to use force to try to evict these demonstrators. If they do, and then this turns into fighting, and particularly if some of the demonstrators get shot, that creates an incentive for Russia to go in, even if Putin doesn't want to go in.
Uh-huh.
And so I think waiting them out is the best strategy.
Now, this has a domestic dimension here, too. We heard mm-hmm. from Secretary of State John Kerry there. Let's listen to, in that same meeting, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee meeting yesterday, Republican Senator John McCain pressing Secretary of State John Kerry about why the U.S. isn't providing Ukraine with arms to defend themselves.
Your view of what the Ukrainians need is vastly different from what the Ukrainians think they need, which is a sovereign right to try to defend themselves, which is something that we have done historically, helping people who are struggling against an overwhelming odds. I thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, John, if I can just say to you, I just said to you, we are evaluating with them exactly what their needs are. And we'll come back here and ask you.
They've said what they needed, what the needs are, a long time ago. And you and I could sit down in 15 minutes and tell them, and knowing what their needs are.
John McCain and John Kerry. Jim McCormick, explain a little bit more about the divisions here at home over this crisis.
Well, the difference, it seems to me, is how much the United States would provide. In this instance, I think what Senator McCain is referring to is military assistance. There has been congressional action in terms of providing some economic assistance. How quickly that economic assistance gets there, I was gratified to see that the EU now has a committee working on to provide economic support to Ukraine. So I think the division is over providing economic assistance, or do we go one step further in terms of taking some signal military action to, I mean, McCain is really talking about providing greater credibility to the kind of threat that has mm-hmm. been made as you opened the program, in terms of what NATO has said, as well as what the U.S. has said. I think he would like to see some demonstration of the credibility of this threat. I mean, I think one of the tensions here is that the sanctions imposed so far have met mixed responses from the Europeans, but they also have been are viewed by some as kind of a pinprick against the Russians, and not severe enough to really signal Putin of what the limitations of his behavior should be.
Now, NATO has warned Russia that, as you referred to there, Jim, that further intervention in Ukraine would be, quote, a historic mistake with grave consequences. Yesterday, the Secretary General of NATO, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, said Moscow must pull back troops that has amassed on the Ukrainian border. I'd like to get your views from both you and Wayne. Wayne, you and Jim. Wayne, start us off. How great is the risk that Russian troops could invade other parts of Ukraine?
Well, I think there is a risk, but I think it's different than the Crimea, and I think the risk is less than in the Crimea. The Russian troops could well, we don't know Putin's goals. He may well be using these troops as a bargaining chip, if you would, to get more autonomy for eastern Ukraine. If he goes into eastern Ukraine, then he owns the eastern Ukraine. Then he's got to take care of the economy of the eastern Ukraine. That will be expensive, as Crimea will be expensive for Russia. He also will have to administer the country. There is nowhere near the same kind of support for Russia in eastern Ukraine that there was in Crimea. So I think we should be cautious in saying that the likelihood of his invading eastern Ukraine is as great as it was when he went into the Crimea.
Jim McCormick, do you see it that way as well?
I don't disagree with that. I think part of this is sort of this imitation effect. I think that Putin wants to have a government in Kiev that's at least more malleable, that is at least more responsive to Russian interests, not in a direct way, but certainly doesn't want Ukraine to join with the West in a kind of a formal way. And I think part of this is trying to intimidate the Kiev government so that they will at least be more responsive to Russian concerns and interests. I think Wayne is right on the mark when he talks about, you know, if you break it, you own it. And they would have to repair the eastern Ukraine, and that would be really costly for them. Plus, they would get some sanctions from the Western countries.
Well, we had the NATO Secretary General talking about historic mistakes and grave consequences. Can we imagine what those would be?
Well, I immediately thought of enacting Article 5 of the NATO treaty, but of course, Ukraine is not formally a member, but they do have a kind of a work, or they're a Partnership for Peace member, and they also, going back to the late 1990s, they have a special kind of consultation with NATO. So I'm not sure what Rasmussen was referencing, but if he was referencing Article 5, I'm not sure there's any stomach for that.
Let me add, I think some of the dire consequences are not short term. They might be long term. And what I see may be happening if Russia does go into Ukraine is an intense effort on the part of Western Europe over time to decrease their dependence on Russian gas. And I think that would be very costly to Russia.
Mm-hmm. I think that is likely to be the case. But talking to people about, you know, the gas situation, the transference from Russia to, say, another source like the Americans with the fracking and all that, are going more towards Norway, for example, which is another major source for European gas. There's an infrastructure problem that would delay the placing on of sanctions, effective sanctions, immediately.
Yeah.
Now, on that gas question, another development today, the President Putin suggested that the state-controlled energy company there, Gazprom, should make Ukraine pay up front for its gas. But he also said, according to reports, they should consult with Kiev first. Ukraine, according to this report, owes Gazprom $2.2 billion for natural gas supplies. Recently missed a payment deadline, too. So I wonder, this crisis, a wake-up call for Europe, certainly, not to get too dependent on gas from the east. Germany, I think, gets a third of its gas from
the
east.
Right. Yeah.
That's correct. And the Baltic countries get all of their gas from Russia. Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania.
And that's what you're talking about, the long-term consequences, is that Russia's damaging its markets for energy.
That's my sense. But Jim is right. It's going to take quite a long period of time to do that.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about talks next week. I'm not sure what we could say about this. The EU, Russia, the U.S., and Ukraine are due next week to talk. A four-way meeting. This would be the first four-way meeting since the crisis erupted. Talks aimed at breaking this impasse, going back to the annexation of the peninsula of Crimea in February. Can either of you say the significance of this meeting? Just getting together is significant enough.
I guess it is significant in terms of getting together. But, you know, Sergei Lavrov is really quite the negotiator here, and has been able to sort of draw these out, these discussions out with very little action,
and not agreeing with the West storyline at all. They're like two different stories running parallel. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, you know, they, in terms of the interpretation of why Crimea had to be, you know, move towards a referendum and join with Russia, there's just entirely, as you put it, a different storyline.
Mm-hmm.
Let me add to that. I think the meetings will be important because we'll get some sense of exactly what the issues are the Russians are going to put on the table and what the Allied response will be to that. I mean, Russia will probably want acceptance of their takeover of the Crimea. They will probably want complete autonomy or federalism and complete autonomy for eastern Ukraine. They may want a veto power over some of the decisions that the Kiev government makes. I see a long set of negotiations going on here before you get any kind of settlement.
Well, I hope it does go on for some time because the other critical juncture here are the elections in Ukraine themselves.
Mm-hmm. What is the date on those again? Do you know,
I think
Jim?
At May 28th, but maybe, Wayne, you have the exact date.
I don't have the exact date, but that's my recollection.
Yeah. It was late May. I think it's May 28th. And so having those elections, and if they sort of legitimize the Kiev government, I think that would also be a very good bargaining chip for the Western powers.
Yeah, and I think actually the Russians would like to be able to influence that election and get a presidential candidate elected who is more sympathetic to them. I'm not sure which of those candidates at this stage will be, but the sense being that if the right person gets elected, the Russian pressures might decrease.
Mm-hmm. Wayne Moyer, Jim McCormick, a political analyst on This Politics Wednesday. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. A few moments ago, Wayne, you talked about it's unclear. We don't know what's in Putin's head, what his goals are here. Jim, can you enlighten us any more?
I really can't. I mean, you know, obviously there have been very psychoanalytic approaches here in terms of what his goals are and what is he looking back to an earlier era of Russia, or is he drawing on the former Soviet Union? I just do not have a good crystal ball on Putin here at all.
Okay. Let me throw this out to you before we break in about 5 minutes. What about the criticisms that we're hearing from various quarters more generally of President Obama's foreign policy? Aside from the Ukraine, we have the Middle East peace talks falling apart, the ongoing violence in Syria, negotiations with Iran. Now, it was once seen as an Obama administration strength of foreign policy. Can it be called a strength today, Wayne Moyer?
I think the problem that Obama has is that the country and I think the U.S. military is not yet ready for another military involvement. And I think that's very much constraining what the president can do at this stage of the game. In a way, he got too far out in front but when he drew the red line in Syria, which then he wasn't able to pull off in terms of a military response to it. So I think he is constrained, and whether it's a strength or a weakness, it's hard for me to say at this stage.
Jim McCormick, what grade do you give the president's foreign policy?
Well, I think it's a wait and see, really, because there are a lot of issues hanging fire, and it's not one that he can, you know, we had bin Laden at the sort of the end of the first term, but there's nothing that you can point to right at the moment that where we have a foreign policy success. I mean, if you go through the litany of Syria, the Middle East, you know, Iran talks are still unfolding. This Crimea has come up in Ukraine. I would say that Secretary Kerry has been trying to tackle some of these problems. I think he gets some credit for being more of a risk taker in the foreign policy arena and instead of sort of some of the holding action that we saw with Secretary Clinton. So I think it's possible. I'm a little disappointed that the Middle East peace talks, I don't know if we'll talk about those, seem to be collapsing once again. I mean, it's not a new ending for those kind of talks, but given the kind of impetus that Kerry put on them and seeing this as kind of a real singular achievement that he wanted to have, I am a bit disappointed.
Well, do update us. This is a good moment for you to spend a minute or two to tell us what is happening happening with the Middle East peace talks and John Kerry?
Well, John Kerry started last July and set a sort of a 9-month goal to achieve a framework agreement. I laugh at that only because we've talked about a framework agreement for resolving the Middle East back to the Camp David Accords, as I tell my class. I mean, the framework has always been there. It's really trying to put the pieces together in that framework that has been the issue. But the goal was to set up a framework agreement by the end of April, end of this month, and then presumably move on to an agreement here. A two-state solution is the basis of this, a Palestinian state and Israel here. But they've really met some roadblocks here lately. The talks have been kind of stalled since November of the last year. And then there's been some more settlements that have been started in Jerusalem by the Israelis, and that the Palestinians now have gone ahead and joined, I think it's 15 different international organizations, using their statehood status that they gained in the United Nations General Assembly back in 2012, at the end of 2012, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so that is going to be another stumbling block that has to be, because those international organizations could be a forum for the Palestinians to take on the Israelis, and that has halted the Israeli kind of movement on this, as well as the Palestinians have pointed out that, you know, part of the initial agreement with Kerry back in July was the release of Palestinian prisoners over a 4-stage episode here, and the last part of that has not been fulfilled by the Israelis. So things are really at a standstill. The biggest singular thing that indicated that they're kind of at a broken stage was that after Secretary Kerry met with Lavrov over the Crimea situation, over the Ukraine more generally, he was supposed to go back to the Middle East, but he turned around and decided to come home instead.
Let's try to squeeze in Dennis listening in North English before we take a break here in just a minute. I have to make it quick, please. Dennis, what is your question or concern?
Sure. I mean, we have a small export business to both countries. And
both countries? You mean Ukraine and Russia?
Correct. And honestly, the Russian-speaking folks in Ukraine are really pro-Russian. They really don't think the rest of the world can do much about whatever actions that they're going to try to take. The consensus in Russia is, as far as our customers are concerned, is that Russia isn't going to try to grab any more of Ukraine, and that Crimea belonged to Russia to begin with, and it was unfairly given away. And so that's where we stand. And I kind of agree with it. I feel like right now, at least, Putin has the rest of the European Union kind of over the barrel because of the energy dependency that they have.
You have an export business to both Ukraine and Russia. What has this crisis, quickly, we've just got a few seconds, done to your export business? Chilled it at all?
No, not really. I maybe even picked up the pace just a little bit in Russia just for the fear that they may not be able to get our product. But, you know, for the most part, nothing.
Okay. Dennis from North English, thank you for chipping in those thoughts. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We'll continue with our discussion of politics. Jim McCormick with us of Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. We hope you'll join our conversation. Also, when we come back, maybe we'll finish up with a little more on Ukraine, but we'll also talk about some other topics. President Obama signing 2 executive orders designed to encourage contractors to pay men and women equally. Governor Branstad firing the head of Iowa's administrative department. That's all to come. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Great to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, the super and frequent users of Iowa's emergency department, some people visiting the ER more than 15 times a year, will explore how frequenters to the ER drive up costs, and we'll take a look at a program at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids that managed to cut down super user visits to the ER by 26%. A visit to the ER tomorrow. A look at that. Today, politics. Wednesday, our guests, Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College, Jim McCormick, Professor and Chair of Political Science at Iowa State University. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. You can also join us via Facebook. Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Last half hour, talking much about the re-escalation of the crisis in Ukraine on the heels of the annexation by Russia of the Crimean Peninsula. Let me throw this out to you. Tim, writing to us an email, listening to this program, he says, my son is a recent graduate of the University of Iowa. He is a finalist for a Fulbright Fellowship to Ukraine for the next academic year. Do you think it would be safe to accept it if he is chosen? Would it be better to stay in Kiev and points west, away from Crimea? I don't know if we have the expertise here to answer that, but Wayne or Jim, would you like to respond?
My guess, this is Wayne, my guess would be that it's probably okay. I personally doubt that Putin's going to send his army across across Ukraine, and I think the likelihood is that there will be long negotiations, but not military action.
Yeah, I think the U.S. Embassy would really take good care. They take very good care of Fulbright people in a particular country, and the kind of advice that the State Department would provide would be, I think, a good source of information for this individual.
Let's move on to domestic politics. Yesterday, President Obama touting executive action that he was taking to help narrow the gender pay gap, also pressing Republican lawmakers to get behind the proposed Paycheck Fairness Act. This is in a White House ceremony. A bit of audio we'll hear here. President Obama outlining his executive action, encouraging Americans to push their members of Congress for legislative action on equal pay.
And I don't care whether you're Democrat or Republican, if you're a voter, if you've got a daughter, you got a sister, you got a mom, I know you got a mom, this is something you should care about. And I'm not going to stand still either. So in this year of action, I've used my executive authority whenever I could to create opportunity for more Americans. And today, I'm going to take action, executive action, to make it easier for working women to earn fair pay. So first, I'm going to sign an executive order to create more pay transparency by prohibiting federal contractors from retaliating against employees who discuss their pay with each other. All right. Pay secrecy fosters discrimination, and we should not tolerate it, not in federal contracting or anywhere else. Second, I'm signing a presidential memorandum directing the Department of Labor and our outstanding Secretary of Labor, Tom Perez, to require federal contractors to provide data about their employee compensation so pay discrimination can be spotted more easily. When women succeed, America succeeds. When women succeed, America succeeds. It's true. I believe that.
President Obama yesterday in the Rose Garden. Now, today's news, day after that Democratic push, all hands on deck for legislation to close the wage gender gap. Senate Republicans have blocked the measure. As expected, this Paycheck Fairness Act failed to meet the 60-vote threshold needed to advance debate in the Senate, 53-44. Wayne Moyer, talk a little bit about why the president would do this when it doesn't look like legislation had any hope.
Well, there are a lot of federal contracts, and there's a good part of the workforce which is affected by federal contracts. And so this is an executive order, I think, that actually will achieve some results. If people know how much other people are making, and if companies have to provide information about pay discrimination between men and women, I think just putting things out in the public will have a positive effect in terms of equalizing pay, even if it won't be as good as full congressional action.
Jim McCormick, a shrewd political move by the president here?
Oh, I think it is. It's certainly an issue that the Democrats want to use in the congressional campaign against the Republicans here. I think one of the things that what might stall this, it seems to me, though, is this whole issue of what are equal jobs and, you know, in terms of making wage comparisons. I suspect that that'll be part of the conundrum that will have to be faced even by these companies that are forced to report their report their wages. So maybe Wayne's right that it will produce more, but I think it also can be slow walked a little bit by those concerned about this.
Is it agreed that this often touted figure, the census figures that's showing women averaging 77 cents for every dollar that men earn? They're pushback on that, or is that agreed by both parties? We know.
I think it's recognized by both parties. That there has to be something done in terms of it. But whether I think it's a question of whether the federal government should be trying to impose this or simply try to make it as a social issue in the country.
Wayne Moyer, how are Republicans responding to this move by the president?
Well, they're obviously going to try to change the subject as much as possible and
call it politics, not good policy.
Indeed. And bring up issues that perhaps women have not been in the work or the average workforce experience in terms of numbers of years of work for women is less, and men stay in the workforce longer. That's why their pay is larger. Issues that may or may not even be accurate, but to kind of confuse the subject and change the subject.
Let's look at some political developments right here in the state of Iowa. Yesterday, Governor Terry Branstad fired Department of Administrative Services Director Mike Carroll after documents surfaced showing he lied to the governor and a state house committee over confidential settlements for laid off state workers. Let's travel back to this program on Monday to hear Governor Branstad reasserting his support for Administrative Services Director Mike Carroll. This was a few days ago.
I had a very long discussion with the director of the Department of Administrative Services, and Mike Carroll. He assured me that there was no additional money provided for people agreeing to confidentiality. But I told him I was very upset because my administration has taken a strong position for openness and transparency, and I felt that confidentiality agreements are wrong. And he apologized for that and assured me that this will never happen again.
So an apology, you don't see this, though, as grounds for termination?
Well, at the time, I was not aware of it. And that's – no, I guess my feeling is if it ever happens again, against when I have a clear directive in the executive order, then we will see, as I said, heads will roll.
Okay, and heads did indeed roll. That was the governor on Monday on this program with my colleague Clay Masters. Documents surfacing shortly after that showing that evidently Mike Carroll lied to the governor, I think outed by the Des Moines Register. Wayne Moyer, what's the significance of this firing?
Well, it embarrasses the governor considerably that he had to do this, that he had to sort of change his mind, and that in fact, the sense being that he's not in. If one staff member can keep things from him, perhaps could other staff members keep things from him as well? And so it gets at the question of his administrative ability, or at least that's what the Democrats will probably try to do in terms of the election.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick, any political fallout for the governor on this issue? Perhaps a toehold for his Democratic challenger, Jack Hatch, potentially something bigger?
I think a series of issues. I mean, what Senator Hatch seems to be trying to do is to raise a series of issues about, the competence of the governor terms of carrying out his official functions. And, the real question is, why didn't he know? Why didn't he ask? What's puzzling to me is why Mr. Carroll didn't talk to apparently he's saying he didn't talk to his staff that I guess were involved in these kind of agreements and before he testified. Or maybe he did, and maybe he did frankly, mislead the legislative committee. I don't know that. But and the governor should have probed, it seems to me, or at least seems to me, should have probed his director before he goes and testifies, so that everything is clear as to what really happened. So I think there's some disjuncture between sort of the testimony and what was the kind of bureaucratic control here. And I think that's the wedge that Senator Hatch will try to make use of.
Paul is with us from Mason City on this issue. Paul has a few words. What do you want to chip in?
Well, I find that the tactic that's been repeated by Terry Branstad, he did it before in the trooper incident, and now he's done it with this, with the hush money discussion. And when that comes up, his automatic response is to talk about, you know, we have employees who have, committed sexual abuse and that sort of thing. All that information should come out. He's conflating these two issues, and he's really, it's kind of McCarthyism for the people who were paid off by the state. As far as I know, it wasn't their fault that they were fired or that they were let go or reduced.
Comment from Wayne or Jim on that call for Paul in Mason City?
I think there's more to probably be probed here by the legislative committees as to exactly, you know, what was the intent of these confidentiality agreements. It's not clear to me, at least from being sort of reading the press on this, what was the ultimate aim or what was the motivation for why these confidentiality agreements?
Do you see this fading or having legs and continuing on for several weeks, Wayne?
I think it has legs because there's still a sense that there's unknowns out there, and my sense is people will keep probing until it's all out.
You see it that way too, Jim?
I think so. This is an election year. We shouldn't forget that.
Right. Let's talk about not only this election year, but we are already have been several times talking about 2016. In fact, some things happening here in Iowa having to do with the 2016 caucus. Vice presidential nominee in Wisconsin, Congressman Paul Ryan, headlining the Iowa GOP's Lincoln Dinner in Cedar Rapids this Friday. Jim McCormick, size up Paul Ryan here in Iowa. His chances in the caucuses, should he declare himself a candidate?
Well, I think, you know, his vice presidential run certainly gives him the first element here in terms of name recognition. He's a neighbor to Iowa from Wisconsin, really from southern Wisconsin in Janesville. He seems, young, bright, energetic. And I think that that will probably help him. It'll be interesting to see if he can garner any support from sort of young people, which is, you know, what a Republican nominee will ultimately need. And I think his views on, you know, budget control and budget cutting are fairly well known. And, of course, that will cut in different ways. But certainly with in terms of the caucuses, that will also elicit support from those in the Republican caucus that are particularly focused on budget management here. But so those are some of the, I think, advantages that he has in terms of running in Iowa.
Wayne Moyer, anything to add to size up Paul Ryan, who will be speaking at Iowa's GOP Lincoln Dinner in Cedar Rapids this Friday?
No, I think Jim has it right. I think certainly as a Wisconsin congressman who's already pretty well known in Iowa, he has a good chance of building support here.
Last night at the Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition spring fundraiser, former Arkansas governor and presidential candidate Mike Huckabee gave the keynote speech unofficially. This former Republican presidential candidate turned Fox News host was in Iowa to hold a series of private meetings, and he is seriously considering a 2016 bid, he says. Huckabee apparently met behind closed doors with our governor, Terry Branstad, and other state GOP leaders, according to reports. And in addition, he also huddled with several members of his 2008 campaign team that was based in the state. We go back to 2008. It was a surprise victory that he won the Iowa caucuses in 2008, but lost the GOP nomination to the center-right candidate, John McCain. This is a bit of Mike Huckabee speaking last night at the Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition's spring fundraiser on the subject of same-sex marriage.
heard people argue with me and said, well, Jesus never said anything about marriage. I said, yes, he actually did. A man shall leave his father and mother, and a woman shall leave her home, and the two shall become one flesh. That's a marriage ceremony if I've ever heard one. Look, I'm not against anybody. I'm really not. I'm not a hater. I'm not homophobic. I honestly don't care what people do personally in their individual lives, but I tell you, the reason when people say, well, why don't you just kind of get on the right side of history? I said, you got to understand, this for me is not about the right side or the wrong side of history. This is the right side of the Bible. And unless God rewrites it, edits it, sends it down with his signature on it, it's not my book to change. Folks, that's why I stand where I stand.
Mike Huckabee last night at the Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition spring fundraiser. Interestingly, gentlemen, the Des Moines Register poll from late February showing that in Iowa, Huckabee leading other GOP hopefuls, 44% of Iowans saying it would be a good idea for the former pastor to take another shot at the White House. Paul Ryan trailing not far behind, 41%. Wayne Moyer, given the tremendous shift we've seen on some of the social issues in this country in the last 4 years, certainly since 2008, same-sex marriage has gone through a tremendous shift, not only in Iowa, but across the country. Is Mike Huckabee a viable candidate? The polls seem to suggest he is.
Well, I think he is in Iowa because I don't think that the religious conservative right has shifted its view very much on this issue. So it may well help him in the Republican caucuses in Iowa. I don't know whether it will help him nationally in terms of a Republican nomination. I think the same-sex marriage issue is not going to be a critical issue in the final presidential campaign. So I don't, if he were to get the Republican nomination, I don't think it would help him in the election.
Mike Huckabee's prospects for 2016, Jim McCormick?
Well, you know, one of the things that was attractive about Huckabee in 2008 was sort of his optimistic kind of personality and style here. And I think that that probably has continued with his, you know, his television show and so on. So I do think that he is attractive within the party. The question is, I think Wayne's on the mark, how he will play nationally. But I think, as Jeb Bush said over the weekend, you know, the Republicans really need an optimistic kind of candidate and one not with sort of a scold mentality. And I think that Huckabee does have some of those kind of qualities that he can allow people to listen to him, even if they might disagree on particular issues.
You mentioned Jeb Bush, the younger Bush, declaring, also making some news this past week that...
Yeah, I think it was a declaration, by the way.
declaring that many undocumented immigrants come to America as an act of love for their families and aren't committing a felony. Interesting there.
Well, I thought he was a declaration for his running is what I meant.
Oh, okay. So let's wrap up by having each comment about what you'll be watching in the week to come. Wayne Moyer, will you start us off?
Well, I certainly continue to watch the Ukraine and continue to watch whether the Israeli-Palestinian talks break off completely or whether they're able to sort of nurture them just to go along, even if it's clear they're not making any progress toward a comprehensive agreement. I think it would be a success if the talks themselves can at least be salvaged.
Jim McCormick?
I would agree. I mean, I think Ukraine will probably, you know, with the meeting coming up, that's a very important kind of event to watch and the kind of actions that take place there. I guess the other thing, I'd be interested to see if we get some results on the Afghan elections. Mm-hmm. And what will result there. You know, all of the major candidates have said they'll sign the security agreement with the U.S., and I think that will be in a very important kind of outcome. The third one that has sort of just started, I was looking at this last night, actually, are the Indian elections here that are now sort of starting in place. And, of course, India is an increasingly important ally, if I might say, for the U.S. in South Asia.
Mm-hmm. We have just a second here. So India, some people might not see that as too relevant to what's going on here in Iowa. How is it relevant?
India? Well, I'm a foreign policy guy, so I'm interested in terms of what kind of dynamics will happen, because, you know, what happens in India, of course, also affects Pakistan and affects Afghanistan, and with the larger kind of Asian pivot that the United States has taken place by the Obama administration. So that, I guess, that's the sort of the motivation here. I think there's also trade. I mean, relations with India, which have picked up over the last decade or so.
Wayne Moyer, any final comments?
I think Jim is right. Afghanistan will be very interesting. At first blush, the first results seemed to be very positive in terms of this seemed to be a much fairer election than the last one. And what one hopes is that we'll get a new government in place quickly, rather than have to wait the whole summer.
Absolutely.
For a runoff, and then by the time the Americans have got to make a decision is to fully pull out of Afghanistan or not. So again, I think getting a quick result will be very important, and hopefully with a clear victory.
Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, thank you for spending the hour with us and lending us your expertise.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tune in tomorrow. We'll go into the ER to find out about rising costs and frequent visitors. Thanks for joining us.